The DeFalco Files is an entertainment-based program. Some memories of certain events might be fuzzy. All opinions are that of the host. Content might not be appropriate for children and some adults. Listener discretion is advised. And remember, the truth is here. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents The DeFalco Files with FSW owner Joe DeFalco and your host, Matt Michaels.
Hey everybody, it's Matt Michaels here, and welcome to The DeFalco Files with the one and only Joe DeFalco, owner and creator of FSW Future Stars Wrestling here in Las Vegas, as well as 1 year out of a major heart surgery. Congratulations, Joe. How you feeling nowadays?
I feel the same as I did before. I felt fine. And, you know, unfortunately, they found some stuff. And, you know, it's like, if I didn't make it, you know, you probably wouldn't be talking about FSW anymore because Rocky T and my son Joey would have been running it into the ground.
They would have been running pandemic shows, right?
Well, yeah, and they'd be the champions right now.
Yeah. Today on the DeFalco Files, we do have a special guest, Mr. Alcatraz. Al is on the line. How you doing, brother?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, and we're going to get into...
Hey, that was more words than Alcatraz's Hall of Fame speech.
Short and sweet, just like my matches.
You know, we said, hey, Rush was going to induct him. It was going to be 5,000 words or less, and Rush handled 4,990, and Alcatraz did the other 10.
Man, we're waiting for you to give Rush the go-home during his speech.
You try playing the music, he wouldn't leave.
Well, before we get into Alcatraz and the history with FSW and becoming a Hall of Famer, it's pretty obvious that there is a future Hall of Famer who just won a title with a major company. Joe, you want to talk just a little bit about Mr. Chris Bay?
Yeah, obviously we've had him on as a guest, you know, a few weeks back as he was preparing for his X Division Championship match against another guy that we've used many, many times, and probably you would consider FSW his second home. He lives in Las Vegas, Willie Mack. So we were in good shape that, you know, even if Chris Bay didn't win, an FSW guy was still going to be the X Division champion. They had an awesome match. It's funny because the setup for the finish, Chris Bay was working on that. He actually put the video out of the crucifix,
yeah,
and he hit it on Willie, and it looked fantastic. And that's the key about Chris Bay. It's like he's very innovative. He's always down here. And, you know, as Alcatraz can tell you, you know, a lot of guys are fair-weather wrestlers. They want to be the best, but they don't want to do what it takes to get to that level. And as we talked about with Lacey Ryan and Chris Bay and the Unguided, you know, those guys are here more than the upstarts and even our regular roster guys that are fighting for positions. And, you know, determination, drive, heart. You know, Alcatraz comes from, you know, back in the day with Tom Howard, and he knows the whole UPW story. So, you know, he probably seen a lot of talented guys or a lot of the times because they were using bodybuilders and ex-athletes that they would fall by the wayside because they didn't have the work ethic.
What do you think, Al? Is that true about work ethic? And is it surprising to you now to see that wrestling is finally accepting guys the size of, like, Chris Bay, as compared to when you started in UPW? I was over there at the same time, and man, it was, they were really looking for the Nathan Jones, the Heidenreichs, those big guys, Cena. You know, is that a typical change as well?
Yeah. I mean, go back to the first part. with the guys that are making it. The guys that stand out, like you said, it's work ethic, but it's also the guys that have heart that want to stay in and push through. Like the first month, I mean, you can vouch for your first month. You're like, what am I doing here? The first month of training. The pain is like, I was asking myself every day, what am I doing here? You know, it was crazy. But, you know, the guys with the heart and the worth ethic make it through. And then as far as like, I look at it now, I'm like, dude, because I wasn't big back then.
Right.
I was bigger near the end of my career out here in Vegas. So I know that didn't help, but I can remember doing a punching class with Tom Howard running it, and it was Heidreich, Nathan Jones, Cena, and there was some bodybuilder dudes, and it was the scariest thing. These guys, you're literally walking into their punches just hoping they don't stiff you. It was crazy. But, like, yeah, I've seen a lot of those MMA guys, pro football players. They tried to team me up back then. There was an MMA guy, and I can't remember his name. He was all tatted up, even all over his face. And they wanted to put me and him as a tag team, and he didn't last a month in the training. So it's definitely hard work and, you know, the ethic. But you got to have heart to push through the pain.
Yeah, that's true. And with that training you got from Tom, what was your, like, initial impressions of working with Tom Howard? You were totally green when you started. Is that correct? You didn't have any training when you walked in, right?
No. I was out of a school in Vista, California, the Palace of Pain. It was CCW.
Okay,
that's where I started with Corey Van Cleek, who went by TNT. He's a big old farm boy from Oklahoma. And that's when he taught us that mentality of you're going to get your ass beat. And he beat our ass day in and day out. So he instilled that toughness. And then when I went to Tom, it just opened my eyes when he was teaching me the psychology and you know, the things out of the box things.
Yeah.
It just opened my eyes to a whole nother level of wrestling.
Do you remember, Joe, the first time you saw Alcatraz wrestle?
It was probably through tapes and stuff on YouTube, because I remember when we were first putting together the very first show in 2009, I remember talking to Alcatraz on MySpace. And we had talked about him coming in for the very first show. But I believe he had like a shoulder injury and he was banged up, and, you know, he was here in Vegas and not sure his heart was too much into getting back into wrestling. And I just remember we had talked a bit, and then he decided to pass on appearing at the very first show we had.
Do you
that MySpace page there, Alcatraz?
Man. Yeah, it was when I first moved out here. I was still trying to finish. I still had bookings in California, and it just kind of got to the point where driving out there, you know, spending the money just to get out there and back and all that, it just weighed out where I kind of just lost the desire.
Yeah,
lost your smile.
I lost my smile, man.
With that, in terms of at that point in your career, did you already take a little bit of a hiatus?
Yeah, I took – it was almost – wasn't almost it? A year.
Yeah, it was something like that, right?
Yeah.
What was that like body-wise in terms of having to make that decision? Was your body still – holding up to where you're like, you know what, I think I can get through matches? Or at that point, had you put yourself through a lot to where your body was saying, you know, hey, your heart might want to still do this, but your body's saying, whoa, wait a second?
No, I never physically got to that point until the end when I retired from FSW. That's when I was looking in the mirror going, dude, I look like shit because my body was so beat up.
Yeah.
So, it was just back then. It was just a matter of just outweighing the, you know, getting to California and the commitments of these bookings in another state. Just I was just kind of getting over it. Plus, I had a new job out here and asking for time off. You know, just a lot of that life things.
Yeah, sure. So, Joe, you ended up breaking Alcatraz, apparently.
Yes, one fateful night at the Thomas and Mac.
it's going to sound stupid, but it had to be fate. It was meant to be or something, man. I don't even know how to explain it.
Well, give the listeners the story from your perspective, Al, and then we'll hear Joe's perspective on it.
All right, so WWF, that's how long ago it was in coming into town, and I called in a favor for some tickets for my kids because they wanted to go. So the plan was just I was going to wait in line with them until they got through security, and then I'd pick them up after the show. And I was waiting in line, and I think it was one of Joe's students came up to me trying to hand me a flyer, or they handed me a flyer to a show, and, you know, I was like, cool, right on, dude, you know. And then I think, I don't remember if it was Jack Slammy or somebody else came up to me talking about the wrestling school, asking me if I wanted to be a pro wrestler. And I was like, nah, I'm cool, man, thanks, you know. And then that's when Joe came up, and then, you know, we just started talking and we hit it off. And I want to say he stood in line for like 45 minutes or more, you know, and we were just talking. And, you know, he was saying, I've seen a lot of promoters, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
I hate, because I've seen so much bullshit that it's hard to call a promoter just because he runs a company.
Right.
But what Joe was saying, and I could see his vision, you know, I was like, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he lit a little fire under my ass. And so that's what got me back in it.
Don't lie. We know the fact that you were getting to team up with JR was really the turning point.
Yeah, I remember telling you too. I go, I'm a little rusty, man. Give me a minute before you give me a match. So I was like doing that green guy bodyguard stuff for a minute.
Hey, the best started that way. Kevin Cross was my bodyguard. So
yeah.
So Joe, how did that conversation go at the Thomas Mack? And what?
I think I was handing out flyers with my son. We were walking around and I'm like, hey, I think that's Alcatraz. So I walked over to him because I knew we had the conversations back in 2009, whatever. And, you know, this is, like you said, at least a year, maybe more, because we're running at the Silver Nugget at that point. And I introduced myself and, you know, gave him, you know, as he said, the rundown of what we were looking to do, you know. For a guy who'd never really been in the business, I'm very fortunate that I guess the honesty is refreshing to a lot of wrestlers who have respect in the business. I've always said that I've gotten way more respect from the guys who wrestle for me from out of state than I did from the guys locally, because the guys locally just don't know how things work on the outside. And they're just expecting things.
Yeah.
While, you know, I'm very well known up in the Reno, Sacramento area because of the Reno Scum, you know, putting me over, and guys I've never met to tell me, hey, what a great job I'm doing. And it's just because those guys, you know, put over what we were doing. And, you know, it's just like I've told a lot of these guys that are looking for a payday and they're looking to come down to Vegas. And it was like, even with the Reno Scum, I'm like, Eli Drake, Brian Cage, can't really pay you much, but I'm going to pay you what I say I'm going to pay you. There would never be a dispute in that, but this is what we're looking to do. And seeing the success we had, guys like the Reno Scum would drive 7 hours and knew they were getting $50.
Yeah.
And they had enough thoughts in their mind that, hey, you know what, it's a new area, there's a lot of people there, we can sell some shirts, we'll make our money on that end, but we want to really go with this company because they seem to be outside of that Cali area. So we were putting together guys from Arizona, guys from California, you know, even some guys from Utah, from Northern, you know, California, as well as up in Reno. And in all honesty, it's kind of similar to how UPW kind of stood aside from a lot of the other companies in California. This is even before they really got to be developmental and they were using all the WWF guys, because I remember always following them and checking out. And I was just thinking on the ride over, it's like, you know, the tag teams they had Navajo and Gallo, and they were like the top tag team out of Phoenix. They had Modest and Donovan Morgan, and they were the top tag team out of NorCal for Pro Wrestling Iron. They had Alcatraz and Hardcore Kid, who were the, you know, the top SoCal tag team. And the tag division featured all these guys that you wouldn't normally get to see on a show because, hey, they're based out of Arizona. They're not really working California. And UPW was really a place where I saw things and kind of got ideas from. Not that I took any of the ideas, but I'm like, hey, you know what? This might work. Hey, this is a good idea. And then they kind of blew up. But before that, they were just, you know, they were running the factions, and it was Modest's group, and I remember, and it was, you know, Mike Knox and Nykirk, who we ended up using. And it's funny, the similarities of all those guys that UPW used, like I said with Tom, that we pretty much incorporated down the line using the same guys. So, you know, there was a lot of respect on who UPW used. If they used you, that means you were probably pretty good. So it was a lot easier to see what talent that if you needed to bring in, where to look at first.
Yeah, very true. Al, at UPW, were the Ballard brothers already 60 years old, or were they 70 years old?
Those guys can never catch a break, man. You know, it's I love those guys. They're the nicest guys, too. Yeah, but yeah, they're always the butt of every joke.
Those guys. So Joe made a good point. There was so much diversity coming into UPW. Out of that time period, two questions. One, how did the moniker Alcatraz come about? And two, what was your favorite tag team match at that time?
The name came from my original school. We were trying to figure it. Actually came from one of my co-students. And because, you know, you want to pick a name that's going to fit your look and you know, you want a gimmick that you can, that the fans are going to believe. Like if I came out saying my name was Pretty Boy Brian, you know, and wearing some tights, then it's not going to work. You know, I wouldn't even believe it myself. So with my look and stuff, that one of the students threw it out there, and then I was like, hell yeah, it was perfect. And it stuck ever since. And it was just meant to be, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's probably a better name than Rikers Island.
you know, in my in UPW, do you remember? I had a tag team partner before I got with Aaron, and it was he had a developmental too. He was all jacked up. Was it Basil? Bad Boy Basil?
Oh, it was Basil. Yeah.
They. And they put him in an orange jumpsuit, you know, and that was my original tag team partner.
And that didn't last too long, because
unfortunately he passed.
Yeah.
He had you know, issues.
Yeah.
So.
But that opened the door for you and Aaron. Was there a match that stands out, because he was extremely talented, and you're extremely talented as well, and it just seemed like you guys meshed really well.
Yeah, I mean, I knew him from before. Like, we actually did a lot of singles matches against each other before that. But what I loved about UPW more than, like, the matches themselves was we did a lot of fun promos.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we did a quesadilla maker commercial that we were sponsored by a quesadilla maker. I mean, it was a lot of fun. And I think the feud that we did with the Ballards,
Yeah.
That went back and forth, but the promos themselves were I don't even know how Rick pulled this one off. We went into a hardware store and we beat up the cashier and like took weapons, and it was just, the promos themselves were fun, but the matches with the Ballards was a lot of fun.
When you then get approached by Joe and you decide, you know what, I'll take a look and give this a shot. What was it like just kind of starting back up and just getting yourself into, you know, ring shape again, being able to, you know, not blow up quickly? Was it a struggle, or did it just kind of come back to you like riding a bicycle?
No, I was more worried about the fluidity in the ring.
Sure.
If that made sense.
Yeah.
And not as much as my cardio, because I was in the gym constant at that time.
Okay.
But I was just more worried about the timing and everything. I didn't want to look stupid, you know, and clueless.
Right.
But I went and trained. I think when I first got with Joe, he had a ring in his backyard. And I went over there and beat up some of his students. But it just clicked. I think Joe, was my first match with Franco, or I don't even remember.
Yeah, it's hard to, it's, you know, I remember some of the matches that you had early. I remember when it was the craziest match that I think we ever had to this day in FSW was that ladder match where Modest broke his arm.
Oh.
Was that me? That one, weren't you?
I don't even remember that match.
Yeah, it was the Commandos. They tried to throw Modest onto his girl, and they underthrew him, and he landed right on the concrete. It was like the sickest. The finish came out of nowhere. It was just like a total clusterfuck. The Von Dooms were in it. The Commandos were in it. It was you and Modest were the tag, because you guys were doing the Sin City Wrecking Crew with Monster.
702 Wrecking Crew.
702 Wrecking Crew. There you go. That, I remember the Commandos threw the chair at JR, and since he didn't know how to wrestle, because, you know, he just thought he was this big guy who could do whatever he wanted, I remember he picked his arm up and the chair went into the first row and hit a kid in the face.
Oh, shit. That's right. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that was some crazy stuff. It's hard to believe that your first match would have been against Franco, but again, it gets so clouded. It was so long ago, and there's been so many matches.
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely my first feud then, right? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah. Shoot, that one.
He got hurt a lot.
Yeah, do you remember that? Did you see that? Ever see that video, that fan shot? It's on YouTube where it's got like 30,000 views where I beat up Corky, and they say like,
"Oh yeah, of course, that's got to have more than 30,000 views." That was like the first viral video. It was the Bronco Bunch guy, Ron, and it was escaped inmate attacks mentally challenged man at wrestling show or something like that. That was a great spot.
Yeah.
Actually, that set up your first big feud with Eugene.
That's right. That's right. Because that's when Franco got hurt, I think.
And remember, that was the main event, because you were the champ at the time. That was the main event at the very first show we did at Sam's Town.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It got awkward for a minute because we did that three-way. Me, Funny Bone, and Modest for the belt.
And that's when
I turned baby. But then we had to do, for whatever, I forgot how come or whatever, we did that Eugene, and I turned heel right back to heel on that match. And then I turned baby again after that.
And,
you know, it's what the fans wish for, you know?
Yeah.
And Eugene, at that time, Nick was doing the Eugene persona still?
Yeah, he just had the, it was you,
Gene. Oh, that's right, yeah.
Like a U-Gene, because, like, with us, it didn't matter. We weren't going to get, any cease and desist from WWE. But, you know, just for him, marketing-wise, it was a lot easier, you know, kind of like when Christian went to TNA and he was Christian Cage, like, it was a difference. But yeah, because we had used Eugene earlier when he first came out, and then we built up that Corky was similar to the Eugene character. You know, he was the drizzling shits. He was terrible. But the character was over, you know, and people actually cared about it. And when Alcatraz destroyed him, boy, oof, good stuff.
You know, and speaking of that really quick, Al, for you, what was your favorite to work? Was it heel or face?
Heel was just more natural. That came. It's easy to be a dick, so it just came more natural. But it, you know, like just with the experience, I was fortunate to work both. Getting so either way, it didn't matter. But I felt more comfortable being a heel because I felt I could also control the match more that way too.
Sure. There was after that that match with you and Eugene. It looks like somewhere down the line, you had a three-way match with, you were tagging with Franco and Remy against Tyson Tyler and Modest and Johnny the Bull. What was Johnny the Bull like to work with?
Oh, how I hoped that I came off as, like, stiff. But I that's a guy that I learned, you know, I whenever I was around him, man, I just sponged everything I could off him. I learned from him. He was a good guy.
Joe, how long did you work with Johnny the Bull? That came about through Arizona, is that correct?
Yeah, Johnny was buddies with Tyson, and you know, we had some good times with the FSW Arizona, especially the first invasion when Tyson put me in charge of his company. And as usual, I'm always trying to do the best that we can and make it special. And we were working on a feud to unify the belts with Alcatraz and Tyson Tyler, who was the FSW Arizona champion. So there's a place in Phoenix where we did the IWF shows, the Celebrity Theater, a nice little spot. And you know, we brought in big guns for that show, and it was like we had Modest, we had Alcatraz, but we also brought in Sean Ricker, Eli Drake, we had Brandon Gatson, Chuck Palumbo, Johnny the Bull, and, you know, I just still remember, I guess there's still some heat going on with some of the kids from Arizona. They were called the Click. And they thought they were, you know, one guy thought he was Shawn Michaels. Remember the beginning of the show, Al, when basically everybody went in and beat the shit out of the kids?
No.
Yeah, that was the first, that was the thing where as the champ, remember the security guy wouldn't let you in? I still watch it on YouTube once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the whole idea was the setup, and since it was Tyson Tyler's home ground, they wouldn't let Alcatraz in the building. He wasn't on the list. And he basically, you know, thumped the guy through the door and then walked in. But we had set some really good stuff up. But unfortunately, little cold feet on the Arizona crew. And, you know, a decisive decision never ended up taking place. I think it was Johnny's fault. I think Johnny was telling Tyson that, you know, putting you over wasn't best for business in Arizona.
What were your memories of Arizona and that time period, Al?
I think I only, as many of the times that I went out there, I think I only did one match against Johnny.
Wow.
I don't remember if I did. Do you remember, Joe? I think I only did that one.
I'm not sure. Did you go down that one time with Daivari when that crew went down?
Oh, that's right. I forgot. And then they switched over to another building.
Yeah.
That's right. I forgot about those shows.
Yeah. So there was a lot of good things that could have been built out of that. If, you know, wow, if Tyson would have just stepped out of the way and let me handle it.
yeah. Go ahead.
Famous last words.
with the next kind of phase, Al, you got a chance to start a little feud with Tyshawn. What was that like? Because Joe has stated many times that that steel cage match where Tyshawn won the title was probably one of the most defining moments in FSW history. What was that like building up, and was he easy to work with? Because you guys are fairly about the same size. He's a little bigger than you, right?
He's got some inches on. He's a big boy.
Yeah.
He's like, what, 6'7" or so? Yeah, he's a big guy. But no, I appreciate Joe saying that, because the way that Tyshawn and I, our mentality going into that match and then after, is like, we were going to leave everything in the ring and give, you know, like our blood, sweat. We were going to do everything to make this match, like, because I think it was like the first steel cage match too.
Yeah, it was the first one we had did. We set it up, and Tyshawn basically run rampant, and we actually had the first title match at the old school, where we did the double pin to set up the steel cage. That was the first time we pulled that one out.
Yeah. And for Tyshawn, the big guy that he was, people don't realize how athletic that he is. He played football for Baylor. So, you know, wow. He's a former football player, but he was easy to work with. He's super athletic, super humble. And like I said, that match we wanted to not just have one of those like brutal, bloody, you know, typical weapons steel cage match. We wanted to try to give it some psychology.
Right.
And then fortunately, like, it worked out and everything went smooth.
Except that Baldo bomb toward the end.
Yeah, I wanted to go big at the end if I was going to lose my belt, but I tore my groin. I told the referee, I told him to check me after that bump because I figured I was going to get knocked out.
Yeah.
But I tore my groin instead.
Oh. How many weeks of healing was that one?
It was like almost 2 months, I think.
Damn.
Woo. Something like that.
And then we came back with the historic, wasn't it the coffin match in the rematch in Sam's Town?
Oh, that's right, the coffin match, yeah.
Which to me is one of the funniest moments in FSW history, because Al had been on the sidelines with the torn groin, and the rumor was it was time for a little payback on Tyshawn Prince. And then he grabbed the fire extinguisher and turned Tyshawn into the Pillsbury Doughboy. He used the entire can of fire extinguisher all over Tyshawn. And I remember when we watched it live, I wasn't really impressed with the match at all. And then when, I don't know if we were doing commentary after the fact or whatever, but I remember watching it the second time. And that was a hugely underrated match. That was an awesome match, by the way.
Yeah, that the fire extinguisher spot was supposed to happen at a different time. When he threw me in the coffin, I grabbed the fire extinguisher, and right before he was going to close the lid, I was going to hit him with it.
Okay. Well,
it didn't go off. So I got it back in the ring, and he wasn't ready for it, and I hit him with it. His mouth was open.
Oh.
I think he swallowed it. He couldn't breathe. Like, he was,
oh, yeah. Shit. Oh, my God.
Good times. Good times.
And I'm assuming this wasn't a gimmicked fire extinguisher, so that must
have... I took it from my house.
Oh, shit. Oh, man. I've inhaled some of that shit in a small confined space because someone once in a dressing room thought it would be funny just to set off a fire extinguisher. And boy, man, you just ran out of there and just coughing up that shit. That's hysterical that he wasn't ready and just took that whole thing. Damn. Was it, in your career, was it stuff like that makes wrestling fun for you?
It's the boys, man. Like, yeah. If you were asking me right now what I miss about the wrestling, it's not the matches, the pain. I don't miss that. I miss like the boys, hanging out with the boys. I made a lot of good friends, a lot of, like, I call brothers now that I traveled the roads with, you know. And I want to mention, you know, we mentioned the Arizona guys. The Arizona boys go back with all the way back to Hollywood Don Yates, Navajo Warrior John Williams, Mike Knox. Those guys always took care of me. They were good people. And then when I would go out there recently when I was with that, you know, doing the FSW Arizona thing, like Tyson Tyler, Johnny the Bull, those guys always took care of me too, man. I got nothing but love for the Arizona guys. But yeah, the friendships, man, that's what stood out in the wrestling business.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I said, I was on a Zoom with Phenomenal Phil, and he immediately said, say hi. And a couple of the other friends, they have no wrestling background. So they were like, wait, this guy's name is Alcatraz? Like, literally Alcatraz? And Phil's like, yeah, in fact, I don't even know what his real name is. I just know him as Alcatraz. And he's a ginger motherfucker. And it was like, that's kind of a good way to describe you. But that's, you know, that shows how the camaraderie and how much respect you have. Like, the guys love you. Was that something that, you know, coming in to a situation in FSW that you could kind of give back a little bit to the younger guys who were in a dressing room, who got to see how you behaved and how the guys respected you?
Yeah, I mean, you got different kind of locker room leaders, different styles, and I just try to lead by example. Yeah. I mean, that's how I saw Tom Howard. Tom Howard is the most humble guy.
Yeah.
And that's how he was in the UPW locker room. I watched him, and just, you know, that's what I tried to do, is just lead by example. But it treat everybody's an equal. It doesn't matter. And what I try to instill is, like, as soon as you walk in the building, you're shaking everybody's hands. I'd go up to the cameraman, whoever was shooting that day, I'm shaking their hands. Anybody that was in that building, whether they're a wrestler or not, they're a part of that show one way or another. You know, so they're part of the business, and you show them the equal. They're an equal. You show them respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Joe, when you thought about how Alcatraz could help FSW, was that part of the idea of putting the title on him, is maybe to, you know, create that environment, create a little respect, and just like establish, because the company was still fairly young.
Yeah, it was a lot of things that went into that, because again, initially, Derek Nykerk was supposed to be the champion taking the belt from Kenny King. But there was some, again, there's some conflicting stories about why they didn't come and what happened. But the bottom line was, Kenny's time was over. And when, you know, Nykerk, Modest, and Gallo, the elite extremists, they were kind of running rampant. So we felt the move needed to be made to put the belt on somebody. So Modest was the obvious choice. You know, I remember working with him at Cheetah's, and we were talking about it, and he really didn't want it because, you know, with Future Stars of Wrestling, he felt, you know, he was not that guy, that, you know, we should be looking at something else. But in all honesty, he fit. So when Franco came along, you know, here was a guy that was literally driving from Texas, big monster. You know, he got over, but not over huge. I always would complain to him about how he would let a guy like Andrew Hellman, you know, beat him up for most of the match, and then out of nowhere, he'd hit a big move. And it's like, as a babyface, you're not letting the crowd get behind you.
Yeah.
But he was this big monster, and as Future Stars of Wrestling, he was not known at all on the West Coast. He was getting a name following in Texas, so we felt, you know, the time was right. But actually, Modest won the belt off. Trying to remember what was going on, because Kenny did lose the belt to Modest, and then Franco, that's right, Franco won the belt from Modest. But then Modest and Alcatraz, they became a unit, and Franco got hurt for the first of two or three times during his reign. And I think that's when we had the three-way, when Alcatraz and Modest were together, basically, and it was Funny Bone, and basically we had Alcatraz win the title by turning on Mike Modest. And, you know, that started Alcatraz's reign. And we went back and forth with Franco, because I remember one time you worked him, and that's when Corky got involved, and I remember a brutal blood fest at the school with you guys.
Well, yeah, that was a shoot. He caught my elbow caught his forehead.
Oh,
I don't even remember how it was, and he just was gushing blood. Damn. But he was a good physical. That was a good physical guy too. He just, I think, like that you were saying, Joe, I just don't. He needed to work more psychology in the match to get the fans behind him, and he would have been huge.
Yeah, no doubt about it. But, you know, he almost died in a big car accident. He got fucked up for a long time. That's when we tried to bring him back after when you guys did the six-man with Remy and Tyson and Johnny the Bull and Modest. Like, that was his first comeback, and then he got hurt again after that.
Damn.
Oh, damn. Poor guy.
I think he tore his tricep or something. Like, one was first, the tricep, and then the car accident really took him out. I remember pictures. He had this big Hummer, and the Hummer was just, you know, totaled. And I remember the pictures of him, you know, broken neck. He was, you know, facial lacerate. He was a mess. It was like, I can't believe this guy lived.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I know he tried a couple of comebacks. It didn't really work out. You know, he did some bodybuilding and stuff, but, you know, he was definitely a guy that a major company would have looked at if he wasn't injured.
You know, speaking of that, major companies and looking at people, Al, who out of your whole career, you know, you've been around a bunch of guys who have gone on to one of the major companies who've signed deals, who sticks out in your mind as the person you feel overall had what it took to be a contracted, you know, superstar, for lack of a better word?
Dude, Adam Pearce.
Yeah.
Easily, that guy, he should be the WWE champion right now.
Yeah.
Easily. He's an old school throwback, but he can work, and he can work the mic. He's the total package.
Joe, do you see the same type of thing in Cross that Al sees in Adam Pearce, that it factor, that total package?
Yeah, Cross would have destroyed Adam Pearce. That isn't even a question. You know, but we saw it from the beginning of the guys that the first time we saw Brian Cage when he walked in 2009, even though he had a small cup of coffee and a developmental, we're like, you know, this guy, he's got the potential to be something big. And then right after that, his tag team partner hit me up, and his name was Sean Ricker. And Sean Ricker was totally different than Brian Cage. He was in very good shape, but Ricker got himself over by being probably one of the best guys on a microphone in the independent wrestling scene.
Yeah.
We knew that guy was going to go somewhere. You know, we knew that guy had major league written all over him. There are certain guys you look at and it's like, even though they might be, you know, unrefined at the time, and then the next guy that we felt that way about was Hammerstone. And I remember when Al was ready to hang it up, you know, he wanted to put somebody over, and the, you know, I only think I gave him one name, and I said, I think the guy who deserves it the way he works to get that victory would be Hammerstone.
Yeah. Did you see, Al, the potential in Hammerstone and what he was doing? And, you know, he's developed so much. Do you feel that you know, added a little bit to his development of going where he's gone so far?
With or without me, he was going to be where he's at now. Like, yeah. He's a student of the game. And that's what's true. I remember, I think when I was talking with Joe, I even mentioned, I think we said Hammer, you said Hammerstone, and I even threw Cross out there, but Kevin was already over. Like, he didn't need that little push.
Right.
So that's what he said, Hammerstone. But no, I'll take the credit, you know, but, either way, he's still meant for bigger things, man. He's on his way.
Joe, did you see the fans' love of Alcatraz as something that was, you were able to use that to get some of the younger up-and-coming guys a little experience with someone that the crowd might be behind and give them a chance to work a little bit of heel?
Well, it depends, because Al worked probably half his time in FSW as a face, and the other half of the time he was a heel. You know, I remember in Mesquite, there was a young guy that I thought, hey, maybe let's give him a good match and see how he hangs. And that was Clutch's first opportunity to wrestle somebody who, you know, was in the upper echelon of FSW at the Mesquite show. And Clutch got that opportunity. And he's gone on to bigger and better things, because there's guys that you're looking at that they need that match. They need to wrestle somebody that makes them feel that they belong. Because, you know, there's a lot of guys, and we go bouncing back and forth. But at the time, you know, we know who the top guys are. The younger guys know who the top guys are. They want to get to that point. You know, some don't want to work as hard to get there, but they want to be there anyway. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough that not only do we bring in great talent like a Chris Masters for Kevin Cross, but the opportunity for Tyshawn Prince to grow is by wrestling a guy like Alcatraz.
Right.
And, you know, Tyshawn had been training at a different place for years. We tried to get him over. We actually had him scheduled for the first Silver Nugget show, where my famous group that never happened, the Splat Pack, I had talked with Tyshawn about being Slammy Davis Jr. And unfortunately, the owner of AU kind of talked him out of it until a few years later, when one of the members of the Players Club, Jason Cash, came down with Tyshawn and finally got him into the mix. But the way he was trained, you know, he was at the same school Thomas Day was there, but he was trained the same way Thomas Day was at 160 pounds. And he's bumping around and flopping around for guys that are, you know, 150 pounds less than him. We created the monster. We turned him into a monster. You know, I've told the story before where, you know, some people would say, hey, you need to humble this guy. He came over from AU. And it's like, you know, first impression is the most important. We're not going to job him out to some mid-card guy and then turn him into a monster. The minute he came in FSW, Tyshawn Prince was protected and made to be a monster. Same thing with Kevin Cross. You know, you take guys that are special, you know, and you put them in situations to succeed. And, Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. The guys that don't, well, they kind of fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you can only give opportunities to people that are deserving of it because, you know, people see. Everybody knows who's deserving of something that's in the locker room enough. And in most cases, most people have never said, man, Joe's pushing this guy. He's the shits. He's an asshole. Blah, blah, blah. And if it is, it's very rare and you find out he's an asshole later. But, you know, I'm sitting in the office here at FSW and I'm looking. We got shit tons of posters that are up here. And I'm looking over. And every poster I see, whether it's just the homegrown guys, I'm looking at the one from, I believe it was the second No Escape, which was the first time we did three steel cage matches. The first one was the shortest steel cage match in the history of FSW, Greg Romero versus Rush. I don't think it lasted 5 minutes. Then we had a tag match where the Whirlwind Gentlemen wrestled Sweet and Sour. And the main event was a War Game style match, and it was the Commandos and Tyshawn against the Reno Scum and Alcatraz. And that was the step toward Alcatraz once again turning heel. Remember that match with the Spike Luster had?
Yeah, what was that? Yeah. What was that like? I was just literally looking at that match, just staring me at the face here. And what was it like going through that? Because I've heard Joe talk about the brutalness of that. What was that match like for you, brother?
It felt like a clusterfuck with all that. No, there was the talent was huge. Like the Commandos, they're great workers, man. Those guys can go. And of course, Reno Scum, you know, we all know how good they are. But I don't know. To me, it just felt like a clusterfuck.
I remember you were handcuffed a lot of the match.
Yeah, no, that was the Reno Scum. They got handcuffed. That was the finish. They cuffed them outside.
Oh, okay.
So Tyshawn could choke me out with the rope. He undid the rope again.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah.
Is it tough to adapt to matches like that where they're not matches that you know, are using normal psychology and also not matches that you probably have done before. You just kind of are walking into something new. Is that kind of what can make for a clusterfuck? Is just, you know, everyone's just kind of trying to feel their way, but still trying to tell a story.
Exactly. You just answered it. But yeah, because you do want to, you want to still give it a story, you know, to keep the fans interested. But it is definitely hard. If, like when we did the Tyshawn feud, we built it and you built it and you built it to the steel cage, so it made sense and everything, you know, flowed. But yeah, this one was just kind of put together, and it had that feel because of that was just kind of put together.
What was your favorite match that you were able to have in FSW?
Man, I don't know, man, because there was a few of them. I actually liked the Eugene match. I thought it was pretty fun because it was kind of like, it was kind of out of my, what I normally do, you know what I mean? It was out of the box of Alcatraz, like the stuff I did, the way I had to sell things for him.
Yeah.
It was kind of different, you know. There was some comedy in there, and that one always would stand out. But the whole Tyshawn feud was, you know, I really didn't have a favorite one. I just liked, you know, going back to what you guys were talking about with me working a lot of the younger guys.
Yeah.
I think back when we were down, the school was down at Boulder Highway. I think I did matches against, like, there was those two cliques you had, Joe. You had the Hater Nation and then the one with Hefe in it. The other
clique. Enemies of the State.
Enemies of the State. Like, I think I wrestled like each and every one of those guys, like in each clique, and you know, the younger guys and all those. There was just it was just a lot of young, fun matches because everybody was just humble, you know, and there was no egos. They listened. Yeah.
I'll give you an obscure match that I really enjoyed. We built it as the Battle of the Bruiserweights in Mesquite, and it was Al, Brian Cage, Willie Mack, and Tito Escondido. That was a fun match.
For you.
You know,
I'm not a three-way or a four-way guy because I hate to remember a bunch of spots, and that's what that match. I mean, don't get me wrong. The talent was. Look where they're at now. Most of those guys in that on that match. It was a good match. It was just I hated, doing those kind of matches because you just got to remember a bunch of stuff.
Joe, you know, because I'm looking at that match too, thinking, man, you had Willie Mack, who obviously was the X Division champion, and you got Brian Cage, who is the Fuck the World champion right now.
Yes. You know, that was a long journey for him to win that title. Who did he beat again?
that should give you an idea of, you know, hey, if you just make up a belt and put it on someone.
We got more than enough belts. We have two belts that don't even have a champion yet. I think we're good.
Hey, speaking of that, Al, you ready to come out of retirement as a Hall of Famer and hold one of the vacant titles?
Should I probably pull a muscle walking to the ring?
So, speaking of Hall of Fame, what was that like when did Joe contact you and say, hey, we're doing this Hall of Fame and we'd like to put you in? What was the process and what was it, you know, like for you to be recognized as a Hall of Famer?
Yeah. Joe called me and told me that they were going to do it. But I mean, it just kind of, you know, you appreciate it because it's kind of a compliment to your career, you know, and even more because how Joe takes the wrestling business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a joke to him. It's very serious. And even like, he's not just going to put some clowns in the Hall of Fame that's going to be with the FSW name behind it. You know what I mean? So, you know, I appreciate it. It meant a lot to me.
And Joe, with the renovations that you've done on the place and you're going to be doing banners, do you think Alcatraz as a Hall of Famer will get a banner up there?
Well, we're kind of discussing the idea of actually having each class have its own individual banners.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, the first class would have been Alcatraz Rush and Nick Bockwinkel. Then we had Al and Duck Tyshawn. And, you know, we've progressed. And unfortunately this year, we didn't get the opportunity. So, and the way things are going, it looks like there will be no 11th year anniversary show until, you know, June of next year. So, you know, we were holding out hope that maybe in July, maybe August, we could still pull off the anniversary, but we're not going to have an anniversary show in December and then come back with another one 5 months later. So, you know, there's definitely, you know, something to it, you know. We had Disco in, and I was actually very surprised about – he's probably had the second longest speech of anybody. Like, I thought he was going to take it as a joke, but he genuinely appreciated it, as did all of them. And the first one, you know, when I first came up with the idea, I didn't want it to just be, hey, who's done shit for FSW? They're going to be in the Las Vegas Wrestling Hall of Fame. And it's like, well, it's the Las Vegas FSW Wrestling Hall of Fame. We kind of control it. And there was no bigger star from Bill from Vegas who lived here many years and Nick Bockwinkel. And his wife was still alive. And through Scott Hosey, we were able to have her show up. And it was a pretty cool moment, you know. And it continued, you know, to see – one guy who may have been just a Las Vegas wrestling legend, like the Godfather, the next year. But we always wanted to incorporate, you know, who was at the forefront. And in FSW, Alcatraz, who was not wrestling anymore and probably had the most, you know, important match in FSW history, it was kind of a no-brainer. And Rush was a combination, not that he ever held titles in FSW or whatever, but he was the forefront of the next generation of wrestling schools, which brought in Legacy and BCW and things like that. So I felt it was necessary to, you know, include him in that group. So, you know, every year...
He was the Legends champion.
He was the Legends champion, that's right. And he was... the company that he ran, I think he had more title reigns than Ric Flair. So, and...
what L would you say from all the things that you've seen in your career? What would you say stands out to you about Joe DeFalco that you just really appreciate? And is there any funny stories that you have in terms of anything that Joe was involved with?
Well, here's the biggest compliment that I can give Joe is that I've seen a lot of promoters do a lot of stupid shit. And on my hand, I can only count that on one hand, the promoters that I have respect for, and it's Rick Bassman, Kevin Kleinrock, Dave Marquez, and Joe DeFalco.
Yep.
Like that's the list of promoters that did it right, did it respectful, and, you know, didn't try to hustle the boys, scam people, you know, just do stupid shit. They did it right for the business.
I am ahead of Marquez though, right? I don't care about the others. As long as I'm ahead of Marquez, I'm good.
You can go ahead of Marquez.
All right, thank you. I'm going to tell him. My son's working for him now at a basketball tournament at the Orleans.
Nice. But the only thing that I got, like, it's something I want to talk, like, the only thing, I don't remember when Joe did it, but thank God he killed it quick, was when the promoter puts himself in the storyline, him and Rocky were doing that, typical ownership, you know, rivalry thing or whatever story.
Right.
Fighting for the company type of, and they did that. And I was just like, no, because that's like, I don't know, man. In my opinion, that's one of the worst, that when promoters put themselves like that, it's just, but thank God he stepped away.
I did it to put over Kevin Cross, bro.
Okay. Hey, there you go. You took one for the team.
That's right. Because we know there's no rivalry between me and Rocky. You know, he knows he's underneath me, and that's the way it is.
I love that the bro came out of your mouth when talking about a Vince Russo-esque storyline. So that was very apropos.
Dead silence. I don't know who you were talking to.
That's all right. I'm used to it. Dead silence. You know, in final thoughts about your time at FSW, is there something that you weren't expecting when you started that just kind of surprised you, or, you know, was something that you liked that you would have never expected?
I think how quick FSW grew. Like, you know, I seen how UPW grew, but it took time. Like,
yeah,
FSW grew quick, and it's a good thing because it's getting done right. Joe's doing it right, so that was, you know, I was very surprised how fast FSW grew and how everybody, you know, people want to come and work. You know, Joe, I'm sure has told you before, he gets. The people that hit him up from all over want to come and work FSW. You know, it's a huge name.
And Joe,
yeah, it was funny watching the Impact pay-per-view, and it was like, Wow, like 14 guys on the pay-per-view have worked our shows.
Is that a combination of the fact that there's so much respect in what you've built and that you have a good relationship with, you know, Impact Wrestling and ROH, and, you know, it lends itself that you are a person that people can work with and trust?
Well, that's the whole thing, was making the connections, and that took years. And that's why in year 11, we're bigger than we were ever before, because those relationships manifested to guys like a Sanjay Dutt, who was, you know, he was a hard worker working for Jeff Jarrett, doing stuff. And then all of a sudden, he became a big name for Impact. And, you know, a guy like Daivari, who happened to move to town, and he'd work our shows for pretty much nothing at the school, and then all of a sudden becomes an agent for WWE. And when these guys and I dealt with each other, they saw that I was honest. I was upfront. I told them, this is what we can do. If they wanted to do it, great. If not, no problem. And it gave me a lot of respect from those guys, that when they were put in a good position, like when I hit up Sanjay and say, hey, bro, what are we, you guys are going to be out here. Why don't you come? And I kind of hooked up the deal for them at Sam's Town. So now I hook up the deal for them to be here for 3 days. Hey, here's a way to get people noticed. How about we do a tryout? And then all of a sudden, they didn't really promote it at all. But because of me pounding the pavement, we had 70 people come in, managers, refs, all looking for an opportunity. And to Impact's credit, you know, 20 or 30 people were involved in angles. They were in matches. They were used as extras, and all these guys got tons of opportunities because the connections that were being made. And it's like, you know, to this day, you know, now D'Lo is being, you know, talent relations, and they knew Chris Bay, but because of that connection and because Sanjay Dutt told the WWE people in Vegas when they were here and they needed somebody for a dark match, he immediately told them that Chris Bay's the guy. Well, Chris Bay got the opportunity. He wrestled on 205 Live. And guess what? We're really interested in you, Impact Wrestling, all of a sudden had an offer on the table the next day. So, you know, there's a lot of great wrestlers everywhere. But the key is being known, being found. And, you know, going back to UPW, that was the thing. That's why people went there. Yeah. They went to UPW because they knew if they were good enough, there was a good chance that somebody big in WWE was going to be able to see them. And that was their golden ticket. And now that's the same thing with FSW, where I got people that'll email me every day, Facebook message. They want to work for me. They want to work. Hey, you know, can't really pay. It's like, we're not going to fly you in from Chicago. And, you know, your $50 is $50, but I'm not flying you in. Oh, we'll get there ourselves, because they've seen so much of our talent move on to bigger and better things because of the combination of everything. It's the combination of the connections. It's the combination of bringing in really good talent for somebody to wrestle, where Kevin Cross got to wrestle Timothy Thatcher, and he got to wrestle Kenny King, and he got to wrestle Chris Masters. And, you know, the list goes on and on of who people get to wrestle, and that's the way you get better. And, you know, Paul London came in, and Bryce Harrison was good, and he went on to the next level because, you know, he learned a lot from Paul London. And it's like, the guys who stick it out, work hard, you know, they benefit the most. And we have a great crew of guys. You know, we have so much talent, we don't need to keep an asshole around if we know he's an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Al, any final words from you about, you know, anything regarding FSW, regarding UPW, your career? Any final thoughts?
No, but just like, to touch on what Joe was just saying, and the reason why FSW got that way is because of the way that Joe's run the company. He got that reputation. All those names that he listed that came through, even the Young Bucks have come through, everybody that's come through, they see how these shows are run professionally. They're done right. They're getting paid on time. They don't got to chase down the promoter afterwards for their pay. You know, everything's done right and professional. And that's why FSW is where they are now. And that's why people want to come and work for them too, you know?
And Joe, any final thoughts on Alcatraz and what he meant to FSW during his time there?
You know, other than the fact that, you know, he was in one of the biggest factions that we had in FSW, you know, he held the championship on more than one occasion. You know, he was a guy that you can go to when a Franco D'Angelo got hurt and you knew he was going to step up and he was going to be the guy. When he wrestled Tyshawn, that was the culmination of really creating the first homegrown FSW superstar. Even though he had trained elsewhere, he wasn't known. He barely had any matches. And when we brought him into FSW, he was legit. And then he got legitimized by everyone because of the work he did with Alcatraz. Yeah. You know, Hammerstone in the retirement match. You know, the guy that I felt was the perfect guy for Alcatraz to end his career with was, you know, the stepping stone for Hammerstone to really move on to the next level. And, you know, it was great having him around because, he's a super cool dude. You know, I was like talking to him, you know, he looks like the guy from ZZ Top now with that beard, but, you know. But he's a great dude. The only thing that bothers me is he introduced me to Tom Howard at the Boulder Highway School many, many years ago. And not keeping him around is like, wow, we missed out on 10 good years of Tom Howard being here.
You know what? I have to correct you on it. It wasn't Tom.
What do you mean it wasn't Tom?
It was Lou Cox.
No, we met Luke Hawks too. Tom Howard came in the back of the Boulder Highway thing one time to say hello when it was a school show.
Oh, okay.
He might have been in town because he said he was doing stuff back in the day with Horseshoe.
That's right. Oh, you're right. You're right. Yep.
But yeah, he's. I'll tell you what. Like you don't realize things. It's like, and then because of Tom Howard, he's brought Marty Elias down, and you know, I haven't brought it up to Marty, but he had heat with me because of stuff in the IWF with Tyson Tyler and Johnny the Bull, where they wanted him to come in and be the head ref. Yet, when I had already brought in Justin and Rick Knox. And then it was like, yeah, he needs to get this, which was like twice the pay and stuff. And that was through Shelton Benjamin. And then when Marty had hit me up like a year or two later and I started talking to him, I mentioned that and he got like offended that he was like, oh, I would never do that. And I'm like, I didn't say you did. I'm just telling you what Shelton Benjamin did. But when I met him, super great guy, super great ref, and he loved being out here. He's looking to move to Vegas. So,
yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Never realized how good a referee is until you see a true world-class guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, again, that's the amazing thing about all these guys from UPW. The fundamentals, the technique, everything, everyone is just solid, and, you know, you look at who's gone on to do things, you're seeing a blueprint that you didn't necessarily design as a clone of UPW. It has your own personality, Joe, but you're going to see that people who have gone through FSW 20 years from now, it's going to be the same thing said about what UPW was, except that 20 years from now, FSW will still be around.
I sure hope so. I don't plan on retiring until I'm dead, so hopefully I'm not dead until, you know, 2058 or something.
Well, I want to thank you guys once again. Al, it's been a pleasure to get you on and chat with you a bit. And Joe, just to let you know, the fans love all your talking about FSW, and you are our number one rated show. And
number one, Alcatraz, did you hear that?
Oh, shit, here we go. You're going to have to put Joe in the Podcast Hall of Fame.
You know, I'm thinking I have to induct myself into the FSW Hall of Fame.
Well, hey, I appreciate you having me, man. And we'll talk soon, Joe.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
All right,
take care, guys.
All right. And once again, this has been the DeFalco Files. You can tune in every week. The truth is here. And don't forget to look up all the shows that we offer from the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. And until next week, everyone, take care.